feast on this one.
Conceptuality is something other than itself.
There's been a change in the image of thought.
That's what it is. That's what it is. That's what it is.
The internal structure of becoming.
As soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject. Thinking with. One, two, three.
Okay.
And now I have nothing to say.
Now the banter's gone.
The clap kills banter.
It's just like the magic is lost. We had incredibly pithy witticisms and shooting back and forth at lightning speed. And then we clap our hands. It's like,
hi.
Crickets.
How has your life been?
Crickets. Yeah. Well, it's like starting the class, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you get the joke around at first. And then once you start, all the kids are like, their eyes just kind of go down. Like, oh. Now we have to learn. Yeah.
It's all about the segue, then. It's all about...
Yeah. Well, the clap kind of...
Sometimes that happens, though. Sometimes you have those, like, whatever you happen to be talking about, you're like, actually, this feeds into the point that we were going to discuss today. And there's usually a groan, but it actually works because it's like,
you know. Yeah. The clap is a little abrupt.
It kills it. Yeah. It's like... Yeah. Hypo segue.
Mm-hmm. It is the worst segue imaginable. Yeah. Imagine if you had to do that in class. All right,
okay.
Time to begin, ready? Everybody.
We're gonna start class.
That's a good place to start, though, in terms of a segue to the beginning of the excerpt, just because, like, it installs that very question of the sort of like the novel and the common senseness, the sort of originary and the glossed over sort of derivative that kind of begins, you know, the project at the outset. It's like, look here, you know, he kind of announces the project at the beginning. We're interested in the question of metaphor in philosophy. And, you know, I think in many ways he's presuming that, you know, there is this sort of natural division between the two, and that when metaphor is used within philosophical discourse, that it needs to be tightly controlled by logic, and that to think about, like, so this relationship is particularly important if it's not controlled from a philosophical perspective. But then immediately he sort of like jumps into this, I'm not familiar with this discourse, but it reads familiar to me. It resonates with Nietzsche's On Truth and Lying, with Blakoff and Johnson.
Anatoly France stuff from the Garden of Epicurus.
It's in the form of a dialogue between Polyphilos and Aristos, right? Which the names are kind of, they're important, like Polyphilos, many wisdoms, against Aristos, the best, right? So you've kind of like this plurality against, you know, the more like the so, but anyway, like the moves of that dialogue are relatively familiar, but I think have their own flavor to them, where it's like basically, and Derrida says this is sort of a common move in the 18th century, is that philosophical language, technical language, which presumes to sort of like get at the stuff in itself, is actually exactly the opposite. It's always derived from a more sort of originary or sensuous, sensory-derived, proto-language. You know, even like the very drive. I mean, it's not shocking that like philology and etymology kind of emerge out of this era as well, to find the true root or origin of the word. And you can think of like Herder in this milieu, and as well as other, I mean, even Heidegger. I think listening back to, you know, our last season on Heidegger, obviously much later, but like there's this sort of, words have this originary sensuous power, and then the more they traffic, the more they get used within this sort of like economic certain kind of like linguistic cultural economy, the more they sort of lose their connection to that originary usage, and the more they become abstracted, conceptualized, made philosophical. But there's always that root. You can always sort of follow, there's always a trace in that language. You can always follow it through back to its originary sensory sense. And that, like, this becomes the sort of the opening for Derrida's investigation. And, you know, you can tell, like, he's suspicious of this, that there's going to be this sort of originary place to track, that you can neatly divide, you know, the philosophical discourse from this more sort of...
And that's where the sun comes in. I mean, this is foreshadowing, but the sun becomes the example par excellence of something which is sensory, but it's not simply sensory, right? It is a condition of possibility for all, you know, you can't look at the sun, and yet it allows you to look at everything. So it's like, it's not, it is and it isn't sensory, and it's this primordial, like, that the notion of the sun is already metaphorical. Yeah. It's already invested in a series of relations. It's not just a noun that later has relations, but we'll get to that. But it's also, like, when you read the sentence that this Polyphilos attempts to activate, right? Like, the return to the original sentence, and then his sort of translation of the sensory, I'm like, what the fuck? Like, that is, that's, it's so bizarre. You just wonder at that moment of, like, what was the dude thinking? Like,
that was like, how is this less abstract? I mean, I get it. Exactly. Like, it's more poetic. It's sort of, like, more sensuous, but, like, it feels incredibly abstract to me. I mean, just... To read them out loud. Like, basically, Polyphilus is like, look, even in the most abstract philosophical languages, let's take, you know, like, at random, let's roll the die and find this super abstract sentence from, I don't even know who this is.
The spirit possesses God. He extracts from a work which reviews all systems one by one from the old Eleatics down to the latest eclectics and ends up with a sentence particularly abstract and speculative. The spirit possesses God in proportion as it participates in the absolute.
So it's just that sentence. This sentence: the spirit possesses God in proportion as it participates.
I thought that was Hegel, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think it was Hegel. It sounds like Hegel, but it's more
lucky. I don't think it is. He doesn't name. He would have named it.
He would have named it.
Is this on the first page? Where are we?
This is 212. If you have.
Oh, okay.
On page 1, 2, 3, 5. Where it's like, okay, so through this process, I can trace each of these abstract words. And it's like the most abstract of all of the words are like the words of negation, you know, like absence or absent, like whatever, like has some kind of negative connotation. But you can trace them all back to some kind of sensory origination. And then he takes each word and he does this. And this is the sentence that he comes up with, because this is somehow more sensory primary. The breath is seated on the shining one. In the bushel of the part, it takes what is altogether loosed. He whose breath is a sign of life, man, that is, will find a place in the divine fire, source and home of life. And this place will be meted out to him according to the virtue that has been given him of sending abroad this warm breath, this little invisible soul across the free expanse. I took out the parenthetical sort of like asides in there, but that's the sort of the one-to-one correlation, which is wild to me. But still, like... Also, I'm sure quite meticulous in its parsing out.
Maybe.
Yeah. So I mean,
it's just weird to me to even just to write the sentences. I don't care what century we're talking about, and to say, "He whose breath is a sign of life, man, that is, will find a place in the divine fire, source and home of life, and this place will be meted out to him according to the virtue that has been given him." Of sending abroad this warm breath, this little invisible soul across a free expanse. It's weird to me to say that is more sensory than the spirit possesses God in proportion as it participates in the absolute. Like,
I
guess it's more.
Are those parentheticals in there? Are those Polyphilos' asides, or are those Derrida's asides, do you think?
It looks like
Derrida. I assume they're Polyphiloses, but...
It's Polyphilos.
Yeah. Because I think if they were square bracketed, it would be Derrida, but because they're just parentheticals, I'm assuming they're the... Mm-hmm.
And he's being smart-ass, kind of like, by the demons, I imagine. There's a smart-ass quality to it, of course, but... And so
it was just the smart-assery that I thought maybe it was Derrida, but...
Mm-hmm. It smacks of ancient Oriental mythology. So, I mean, I think maybe that's also the issue is that reconnecting the sort of Western philosophical tradition to this mythological thing is as well, that mythology is the more, I guess, bodily or sensory way of thinking of concepts. So,
it's Polyphilos then who's kind of giving this little critique of Hegel at the top of 212 then? That's his critique? Or is that somebody else? Yeah, okay. No, so is Derrida buying into this critique, or he's just laying it out?
He's just laying out as the condition of thinking this problem, right? I mean, it would, in some ways, it seems like the edgier, sexier thing to say, like, hey, philosophy is founded on metaphor, even to follow, like, the Nietzschean line. It's like, what we call truth is sort of, like, sensory experience sort of then abstracted and devoid of life. And, in you know, like, the language of white mythology is Derrida's gloss on a line from Polyphemus, which is like, look, all of philosophy thinks that it's getting away from this sort of sensory language, but all it does is through a sort of like strained and unsort of acknowledged process of metaphor, abstracts and covers over this thing, and what it's covering over is just pure mythology, but it's a mythology devoid of sensory experience, aka an anemic philosophy, which then Derrida sort of renders as a white mythology.
Right.
You know,
and also the white man.
Mythology of whack. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The white man is
so anemic and also racialized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. White as the empty category that has no fullness, no character to it.
Right. Well, then there is obviously still a critique of Hegel leveraged by Derrida in here, then, right? In terms of his employment of universals and the negative, right? Like, if we look back to From Restricted to General Economy, you find those coordinates here towards the beginning as well, where he's like, right, we don't want a loss with an absolute return on investment, we want that general economy, right, is kind of what he's going for, right? So it's,
well, I don't know, I mean, just because of the way he's setting up the problematic here, he's definitely setting up Polyphemus to like being too reductive, too simplistic in this, right? Because I mean, a lot of the move that I see here, and this is very interesting to me for rhetorical theory, and especially what sort of like dominated a lot of philosophy and rhetoric in the, I mean, John, you would know better than this, but like the 90s, I would say, at least, is a notion that there is a sort of a primary rhetoricity to philosophy, like, you know, what Plato is doing. Like, all philosophical texts are rhetorical, not just in terms of their capacity, like their orientation of persuasion, but on their sort of like foundation of certain sort of metaphorics and tropes and whatever else. And what Derrida seems to be doing here is then, like, if that's getting a rhetorical rhetoric getting under philosophy, Derrida's getting under that sub-foundation and saying, like, don't presume that there's some kind of pure rhetoric that can then found philosophical discourse, because any rhetoric is going to presume a philosophy and a conceptual network that is grounding the rhetoricity, or like if rhetoric grounds philosophy, a prior philosophy is grounding rhetoric. And I don't think the point then is to find which one is really grounding which one, but is to constantly point out the constant negotiations between like these two forces working on each other.
I feel like the bigger arena in which I saw this kind of stuff, and you still see it, by the way, like back when I actually was writing a book on style.
a time that has apparently passed.
The kinds of projects that people would do about style and philosophy are exactly the kinds of things he describes throughout the essay, not just here at the beginning, where it's like, take Plato's texts and or whatever it is, and look at the metaphors and figure out what is the system of the metaphors that they do. There's a collection called Style and Theory in which people do that with Derrida. I mean, it's bizarre to me, because you go like, wait, he's the guy that told you the problems with that project, you know, or shows you the presumptions with that project. But that is often the way that people approach style questions, is like, let's look at, or, I mean, you think within the field of rhetoric, I think the arena that was most clearly directed at was the sort of rhetoric of science stuff, which is, let's look at the tropes and figures that exist in this allegedly non-tropological discourse of the sciences. And so you're like Emily Martin, Sperm and the Egg, right? Like, it's really interesting stuff, but it was all organized around identifying the metaphors that are guiding the conceptual directions in thinking about, you know, biological phenomena. right? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that, and even, I mean, you know, even more broadly, not just rhetoric stuff, is I think a lot of that is looking at arenas that we presume to be not metaphorical and showing that they are metaphorical. Right. Lakoff and Johnson, right, the sort of primordial rhetoricity or primordial metaphoricity of all language, that all language is metaphor. But he's going after that notion of the primordial metaphoricity, like, or he's attempting to problematize the ease with which that presumption is made, because it presumes, again, a kind of prior fundamental sensory from which the intelligible is secondary derived. And I mean, this is, and the word is aufhebend, right? Like, it is that's where Hegel comes into the picture, is that metaphor is a kind of paradigmatic image of exactly what the relevé, you know, or the aufhebung move of Hegel is it's, you know, taking the sensory and not canceling it, not erasing it, maintaining it, but surpassing it. And so that both maintaining and surpassing thing that exists in the aufhebung is exactly what we mean by metaphor, you know, or it's the movement of metaphor. So I think in that sense, the whole notion of metaphor is underwritten, or one of the things that he's going after here is the Hegelian logic of sublation. I think that you're absolutely right on that. He talks about it kind of briefly. I mean, he looks at Hegel's understanding of metaphor. And also there's a great footnote in that chunk on Heidegger where he's like, this is exactly why Heidegger doesn't trust metaphor. Like, he does not like and won't use the concept of metaphor. Although, as Nathaniel points out, as we talk about his reactivation of the original senses of the words, while not necessarily a metaphor, they seem to have a resonance with the kind of movement, you know, that Hegel was obviously interested in. So,
well, because it's interesting to me, like, the different ways that we can think of, like, the different places in which metaphor functions, because, I mean...
I really get to the point, honestly, for me, I do get to the point in reading this, and this is, it starts here, of course, but I get the point where I don't have any fucking idea what we're talking about with metaphor anymore. Like, I don't have any idea. Like, I just have no sense of... And again, I get the point that he's trying to make is not that there is a continuum and it's all the same. And so my reaction is not, you know, necessarily a helpful one. But I really, very quickly, like, okay, fine. Metaphor means the sensory transported to the to sense, right? Like, to the intellect.
But then he immediately undoes that.
Right, exactly. I mean, and I'm like, I don't even know. And in this sense, I mean, this is a commonplace. Like, all language is metaphorical. But what does that claim even mean? Like, I don't even understand what the force of that claim would be. Now, I get, again, later sections where he's like, it problematizes the idea of the nominalizable, right? Like, that's the characteristic of metaphor, certainly for Aristotle, is the nominalizable, and that you can name a thing. And what he's going to show is that there is a kind of a constitutive, again, metaphoricity or something, movement that's already implicit in the noun, in the signified, in the meaning. Right, like, right. So it's not just a question of there's a meaning that you then transport to another place, right, via metaphor from the sensory to the imaginative, but that original or primordial meaning isn't original and primordial, it's already a product of relation.
So I think charting out some of the binaries or oppositions that get installed in various ways, and I think a lot of this comes down to, I mean, one of the motifs that popped up over and over again for me was the labor that is required to install these various economies that, you know, like various oppositions do work to install a kind of schemata in order to think of, you know, this economy of metaphor versus that economy of metaphor. Recognize me right now.
That, it's the
economy of metaphor.
That's right. But that's an interesting thing to me, because even the discourses that are invested in saying, for example, look, there's metaphor in the sciences. Right. Yeah. Like, in other words, it's trying to undermine this notion of a radical distinction between, you know, the language of the episteme and the language of metaphoricity, even those things start with the presumption of the distinction among spheres. In order to recognize a metaphor, you have to say there are properly economic words, there are properly, you know, what historical words, there are properly whatever, like that these words have their original home and they're transported into another arena. So like even the effort to problematize or complicate, you know, the distinction between spheres necessarily begins with the presumption of a distinction among spheres. Like, it can't not.
I mean, it makes me think of that problem, that paradox of sense, is that, like, in order to sort of comment or take up the sense of something, a new sense has to be installed that is necessarily coming from a bit of a blind spot. And that's kind of what happens with metaphor. And in order to examine... Right. A metaphor, a new metaphor has to be installed from a perspective. Like, in other words, it's just nothing to say, like, metaphors are always established from perspectives. And that perspective is its own unidentifiable metaphoric starting point, which can then be taken up. It's not an originary starting point. It's not a foundation. But I think that establishing a handful of these binaries is valuable. Like, I mean, at least in the sort of... It just in terms of like the temporal progression of them, because the one he begins with is the sensory technical or physical metaphysical distinction. Is that like language has its primacy in sensory physical experience, and then it becomes through a process of metaphor, becomes abstracted, becomes metaphysical, becomes technical. So that's that first binary that is installed. I mean, there's a temporal binary. Temporal and bodily, like bodies have senses, language derives from that, and then a slow process, it's hard to tell where the tipping point is, but they become increasingly non-sensuous. So there's that.
You say that's what I would call a materialist understanding.
Yes.
Right? Like the stuffness of stuff is primary, and the abstracted conceptual is secondary.
Yeah. So then... But then he turns to someone, a reader of Plato, Metaphor in Plato, and this is after the Poly, Philos, and Aristos stuff. And yeah, this is on 219 through like 221, I think. So René's work on Plato's Metaphors. He's like, he establishes a different kind of, or uses a different binary to establish a domain of the metaphor, which is not this temporal historical materialist one, but one focused on authorial intention. It's like, forget about, you know, the distance from some kind of originary. There is a meaning or an intention of the text or of the author, and then the metaphor is a vehicle by which this is transmitted. And so, like, the logic of the metaphor is all internal to the sort of the network of ideas itself, and this is how you can derive it. And then Derrida's move is then to show another binary that has been installed and is operating on this system of idea or meaning on the one hand, and then language or communication on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And so this then becomes the operative binary, and it becomes its own metaphor, right? Like, these dichotomies are metaphorically installed. Mm-hmm. And then there becomes the third one, which I kind of would have figured he would have started with, but because it's just so akin to, you know, the most common definitions of metaphor, where it's just, you know, a metaphor is just using a word from one domain and then to describe something in another domain. So using, you know, like in a kind of an improper usage, catachresis is sort of like the basis for all metaphor. But now we have another binary installed between sort of like the proper and the improper domains of something, like using a biological term to describe a non-biological feature, which, as John, you suggested, you have to have a relatively clear distinction of what counts as the biological and the non-biological, and that there are terms proper to it and there are terms improper to it. And so, like, it's the coordination, and there's obviously a lot of overlap between them, between, you know, sensory abstract on the one hand, proper improper domains, and intention, communication that are all sort of like coordinated in within this the terrain of this problematic. That
this is why when I last
navigating those.
When I last taught this prior to this time around, it was when Trump had just been elected and was about to be like whatever right around that time, and it was this whole build the border wall thing, and I was like, this is a whole discourse on immigration policy, right? Like it's in terms of the proper places that someone is from and the proper ways of allowing movement across borders between spheres, call it the economic and philosophical or whatever else, but it's the same question, like, where is something from?
You're only metaphorically American.
right. But really, it's like, because that's the whole question is setting up this massive taxonomy of, you know, what's indigenous and what's exogenous, and what are the ways of moving across the borders between fields that are acceptable, and in acceptable means provide some kind of truth value in this case, right? And what are the ones that are unacceptable because they're catachresis, right? Like catachresis doesn't generate anything in terms of the truth value of the thing. And especially when you push the notion of metaphor a little further and you say like, well, look, metaphor is just saying this thing is that thing, which is all, it's just the verb to be, right? Like everything connected by the verb to be, which is where that one thing that says to be is the only relevant verb. Everything else is like to be running, to be eating, to be like all those things are secondary to the to be part. Mm-hmm. And it's just saying this is this. Right, that all of that is metaphor. So when I say a camel is a mammal, like I have engaged in metaphor, the transport of something into, again, species to, you know, class or whatever, regardless of. But that's all that you're doing. And so in that sense, every statement ends up being a metaphor, but only insofar as you presume the preexistence of distinct arenas, and a proper home and a borrowed place, you know. So it's like the necessity of having, you have to have borders in order to have travel.
Right. But if you say, like, just the definition of difference, if you say that it's just an endless process of differentiation and deferral without the possibility of there being a stable meaning or origin, I mean, that just sort of gets at the Derridean project as opposed to, you know, the fetishizing of the sensory, the original sensory meaning. That's or in the case of the one that you brought up, Nathaniel, where the sort of reception of Plato, where he's trying to take, is that sort of a new criticism thing where you try to take the text on its own terms without engaging like historical?
That's certainly new
criticism.
Is that new criticism? I think everything likes to do that. But,
yeah, new criticism definitely does. But I think everything does that. Like nothing wants to claim that they are importing their own taxonomies for understanding. They always want to say that they're letting the text speak on its own terms.
Right.
And which is absolute bullshit. It's a total fucking propriety. Like, I'm always, every time I read that move, I just get, like, I bristle with frustration and anger. Because it's like, there is no own terms, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're denying your own culpability in your reading of the text. Like, that's, if everything is interpretation, which Nietzsche says, then there is no, like, valid sort of examination of a text, right? There's no coherent system of the Platonic text that you can just identify and say like, oh, here's the system of words and metaphors, and here's the true meaning. I mean, that's like basic rhetoric, sort of right there. Like that you can't do that, right? Like you can't make.
But they are.
Yeah, and you will
making that right. Making that kind of claim is premised on a series of questionable assumptions.
Right. It was sort of an easy takedown, I feel like, for Derrida in that section of that guy who read Plato. You know, I feel like it was just like that. Yeah. He was just setting him up and just got destroyed.
But it's a symptom of a type of reading. That's what I was saying. Like when I read a bunch of this style stuff, like you just like almost everybody who looks at the role of style or something like that, it just says, let's identify the figures. And then there's a whole structure for how you do that. Like where are the figures in Plato? are they of a piece with the thinking, right? Like, are they, in other words, are they important? Are they relevant metaphors? Or are they just sort of cast aside catacreses, you know? I mean, it's just a commonplace. Because when you think about it, sheerly on a practical level, like a practical intellectual level, but you just say like, okay, I want to examine the metaphoricity of X's work. Like, what are the ways that X tends to talk about things? Well, they tend to talk about it in these kinds of, you know, how else are you going to do it, right? Like, how else are you going to do it other than say, I believe I know what a metaphor is. I believe I can recognize them, and I can then classify them according to the various domains from which they came and then the uses to which they're put. And then I decide whether or not that lines up with what I consider to be Plato's ontology or epistemology or whatever we happen to be caring about. Like, those types of moves that he sees in that, in the one guy that he's reading, is like, those are kind of the only moves you can make. Like, they're, and they're more or less subtle versions of them that you see in contemporary thinking, but they're all there. So Jeannie Fahnestock's analysis of figures in the sciences, which is totally interesting stuff, works exactly like that, you know? And there, and plenty of people that do work following her, and she's, you know, the rhetoric, one of the rhetoric of science, who's like, look at the metaphoricity of scientific texts. And that's how it, that's how it works. Like, you have to presume that you know what a metaphor is, what the original, the lending discourse is, the borrowing discourse, and the nature of the borrow to lend relation, right? Like,
So the presumption,
a lot of it has to do with, like, what's the value in pointing out the metaphoricity of, say, scientific discourse is, you know, like, one of them is to dislodge the authority that that it has. And that's that's a valuable kind of thing.
The epistemic authority, right? The sort epistemic of objectivist.
As in, like, I mean, in other words, like, not to sort of, like, say, you know, the more dangerous version of this, which is, I think we see the ramifications of this in the discourse on the right now, is that because it had a certain air of, like, a certain notion of its authority sort of damage, that now suddenly doesn't mean anything. Well, we can just
doesn't mean anything at all.
Has no authority. It has no authority, has no weight, has no nothing.
That's right.
I was like, well, there's got to be some distance between the purity of its authority and its complete non-value. But, you know, the, I mean, I think, you know, the other thing to say is...
And by the way, that's always a danger. I mean, that's one of the things that I know, like, I kind of had that response sometimes when I read this, and I'm clear that he's not doing that, but certainly lots of people have. It's one of the dangers of doing this kind of thing is, well, you're saying there's no difference between metaphors and concepts, between figures and concepts. Like, the, isn't that what you're saying? That they're basically the same thing, that you homogenize and it just a continuum of these things. And that's not the claim that he's making. You know, it's that you don't know in advance. It is, there's an inscription required in order to formulate the very distinctions between these things. Is something different than saying there's no difference between these things.
Well, I mean, because I think a lot of the drive that he's trying, I mean, in, so I didn't read him as critiquing Pierre-Louis, the Plato guy, so much. Although, I mean, like, obviously he doesn't agree with him, but I, you know... I don't think he brought him up to knock him down. I think largely he's bringing him up to be able to showcase the different logics that are being installed here, and the sort of the fluidity or the ease of transformation between these various notions of metaphor. And, you know, largely I think insofar as he's trying to critique something here, it's that, like, look, you can't create a stabilized terrain from which to advance your project. You can't say, all right, even if you're provisional about it, even if you are sort of like pragmatic about, like, look, I know I'm not sort of dealing with the truth, but, you know, for the sake of, let's imagine that, you know, this is a metaphor, intention is going to, you know, run the show, and then now I'm just going to do my project in here, and at least tentatively speaking, I know that the parameters have been set. I think even there, he's saying that's, like, that's impossible. And it's not even impossible, it's not desirable either. That as soon as you start, like, you can absolutely launch implicitly, explicitly, you can certainly activate a some, like, nature culture binary or whatever, whatever. It's not going to create a stabilized space. It is going to work on the thing that is working on, and it's going to be worked on by the thing that it is working on. So, you know, there is no stabilized space. There's no stabilized, like the binary itself is not stabilized, and the object that it's working on is not stabilized. It's only transformed. Now, that's important. That's worth following through. But what it doesn't give you is a distanced perspective from which to, like, to safeguard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, I do think there's a critique of the Pierre Louis thing in there. Like, it is
it's definitely there, but I don't think it's the point. I don't think, because I Nate's right. It would be too easy. Like,
well, he's just taking this is a symptom, but this is a symptom. You know, like, he proceeds in these ways, but they're not personally idiosyncratic. Like, he thinks that he can get to the organizing principles of Plato's thought via this approach, but you can't. Right, like, and what's required in order to do that is a whole series of, as he says, like, there's a series of paradoxical propositions that are, you know, it's the conception of metaphor that necessarily lends itself to the type of work that, so it's not like the guy made an error or erred, it's that if you have this conception of metaphor, which is, by the way, the conception of metaphor, it's not like there's another one. If you have this conception of metaphor, then therefore you're going to do some variation of this theme. You can't not. So, but, like, you know, these are simultaneously paradoxical and traditional propositions. Louis allegedly has opposed himself to the traditions of the things that he's just done. So, I mean, again, to me, it's always like it's a symptomatic reading, I think, of here is given a way of thinking of metaphor, which is the only way of thinking of metaphor, there's only a certain series of things that you can do. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole morality to that, right, that's built into it. I mean, that's obviously the recurring refrain. Like, this is not a methodological procedure that one can, you know, take care of at first, but the whole presumption. So it's like, look, he ends up being guided, like his notion of metaphoricity ends up being guided not by the metaphors, but what he believes to be Plato's ideas, right? Like, again, we return to, so the whole interest in metaphoricity is to attend to the specificity of the language, of the figural, right? In other words, to get away from the privileging of Plato's ideas and get to Plato's writing. And yet, in order to do that thing at all, you have to. The whole thing is organized around what one believes to be the important philosophical ideas of Plato, and it can't not be. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're re-inscribing the very concept figure distinction that you undertook the thing to get rid of.
Right. Well, and there's all these presuppositions and presumptions loaded into the methodology, so that the outcome, the product, is prescribed sort of from the outset. Or it's prescribed arbitrarily based on the interests and motivations of Pierre Louis or the author. Right? So, like,
I was just going to say, I wonder, I mean, like, just talking about the presuppositions, which is what we've been talking a lot, like, you know, in order to get something off of the ground, you have to be able to presuppose a bunch of things. And, like, one of our favorite things is to point out, like, oh, here's the error in presupposing that. And then the next move is to say, but you got to presuppose something, and there's nothing unproblematic that you can presuppose, so it's like an unavoidable thing. What if, I mean, just throwing it out there, like, what if we just didn't think about it, or we thought about it less as a presupposition, as more of like the activation, intentional or not, the activation or the making work or the making labor of certain, like,
virtual dimensions.
Virtual dimension. Yeah, like, it's not that, like, you know, I accidentally presupposed a sort of like gendered binary here. It's like, no, this thing gets activated,
regardless
of my intentions or presuppositions, because there are particular pathways that connect the two. And by the way, the second they get activated, that gender binary is going to start operating on the thing that I've, you know, inaugurated, and going to get operated on by the thing.
Yep.
And just as a way of trying to destabilize the general specific or the transcendental practical.
But that level of critical awareness or reflection on the process of positing your own presumptions that's, I feel like that's what Derrida does after, and that's what he's saying is absent from a lot of philosophical discourse, is that they're just not, maybe not sufficiently is not the right word, but they're not like adequately attentive to the how their text is produced, you know, that's by their own thinking, you know.
I agree.
So it's all, I mean, the, you know, the thesis, insofar as there's a thesis here, is that it's all catachresis, right? They're just, but there are different styles of catachresis that get routinized or habituated as non-catachretic, right? As metaphors. Right. And then as concepts, right? Like that's, but it's all catachresis. Like,
well, or what's a what's a metaphor? It's a catachresis that I find valuable. So, you know, one man's metaphor is another man's catachresis.
right.
Yeah.
But even the, but take the next step on that. Even the question of value is organized around a metaphorical question of transfer, right? So even that, so it's not just that I happen to find valuable, like it's already built into a notion of value too. So all of the thing, the whole thing is
I think we need a TV timeout on the catachresis thing. Just like for those who aren't like don't have a lexicon of rhetorical tropes, but catachresis is just the misusage of a word, and so it can be often, you know, it can be often just sort of like you use the word incorrectly or it's a mistake. Now it's included in the figures.
Right. Instead of saying instead of saying these conversations are interminable, you'd say these conversations are terminators.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. it often just sounds like you just use the wrong word. You don't didn't know it. You had a brain fart. Whatever. Now it's usually included in like in a list of tropes because it can be artfully deployed as well. Like it can, like this mistakenness of it can be part of the rhetorical artifice. So catachresis is usually included in a list here. And so like the reason that we bring up catachresis is to say that like if a metaphor is the usage of a word outside of its proper domain, then in many ways that is just what catachresis is, except for that, you know, in the metaphoric usages, we can establish a linkage, perhaps an improper linkage, but a linkage between them that we find valuable.
But again, I'm going to insist on this point. Like it's not just that we happen to find valuable. It's what constitutes value that we find is also itself constituted by that catachresis. Yes. So it's it's not just like, oh, we like these ones. It's like no. What liking means, and what we means are part of it too. So it's catachresis.
Values are produced, in other words. Yeah, like values are produced. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We solved that.
Yeah. I don't know if you're going somewhere specific, Nathaniel, but obviously the Hegel thing is, I wonder, because he doesn't fully treat the Hegelian discourse in this text, but I'm wondering what his evaluation of Hegel's version, his style of philosophy would be in this context, because I feel like in some ways he would be kind of buying into the polyphilos line, where Hegel is using the negative almost deceptively in order to provide the illusion of a consistency or coherence of thought, right? So like there's this illusion, there's this facade of the one or of unity in Hegel that's kind of mobilized through his language. And all of this is kind of like deceptive, fascist even in its impulse and drive, right? So like even just his diction and the way the Hegelian sentence moves is all in service of this totalizing principle where you want to be able to identify the ground, you know, of human being or of consciousness or of history, etc.
That's exactly where I don't find Derrida to like be in bed with polyphilos at all, because that's exactly his project, not to find it in within sort of like the transcendental concept, but within sensory experience. That's the origin or the ground, and to me like they're at us turning to him to show
to complicate
the smuggled in philosopheme of like of the physical versus the metaphysicals. Like in order to buy that there is an originary sensory ground from which philosophy is built as an impoverished version of that sensory ground, you have to.
But by the way, let's also say
distinction. Yeah,
but let's say simultaneously impoverished and grandiose, right? Like, yeah. So it's impoverished in the sense of relative to the sensory, but it elevates it. That's exactly the Hegel point, right? Like it also elevates it simultaneously.
Well, that's, I think, Derrida's claim in terms of the economic, like, because he wants to talk about
that's
it in
right.
terms of usury, which is like there is a loss
right.
for, like, a surplus. Would you say that's Polyphilos's claim? Because I
have the sense that... Polyphilos is clearly just negative, right? Like, Polyphilos
yeah, he's just
is
like,
it is,
philosophy is... I mean, for me, I think that Polyphilos yeah. is just saying philosophy is bullshit because it's impoverished, self-deceptive Oriental mythology dressed up
right.
as fancy mm-hmm. talk.
I think that's right. right. And so what he fails to do is the second part of the Hegelian move, and to say it's
yeah.
precisely through that impoverishment that it becomes generalizable and absolute. Like that's how you get
yeah.
to those notions. So the second part of that he gets, I mean, Hegel's right after that, right? On
yeah.
224 or whatever. Where that's what he gets from like Hegel is the one that will teach us, yes, that impoverishment and the wearing away is also what creates the inestimable
yeah.
value. You know, it increases the value exponentially. So the usure, which is the wearing away and the simultaneous,
yeah.
what is the return on the investment of the
right.
the loss of the money?
The capacity to talk
right.
about anything at all, because if we were only dealing with sensory. Like primary
correct.
Sensory experiences, then literally nothing is exchangeable for anything else. So if you want to
although
have any kind
but you'd
of...
have to, yeah, but you'd have to push on that and be like, I get that. I mean, I agree with you on one level, but on the next level, I go like, what could be a possibly purely sensory?
Oh,
like,
I don't think anything.
There's nothing
right.
that would be purely sensory. I mean, that's where the sun comes in
yeah.
as the sort of
yeah.
But
he wants to presume
example.
That like, hey, look, you know, philosophy has degraded this purely sensory
that's
sort
right.
of language
right.
and so like my claim
yeah.
is that presume that a purely sensory language is possible, like I don't think it is possible, and here's one reason is even if
yeah.
at the most fundamental level you could say like, you know, thinking about Nietzsche's Truth and Lies, like imagine you could have some sound utterance that was uniquely hooked to an experience, right? That like it didn't fit for anything else. Then
right.
all you would at most you could get a lexicon without any grammar, right? Because you would
yeah.
never be able to, because every sound utterance would be totally
mm-hmm.
like purely tethered to a past moment. It could never be reused for anything else, which means there would be no transmission, no communication, no repetition across
this is the animal stuff,
any language.
By the way.
Right.
The which one?
This is the animal stuff, right? Like
yeah.
why this is we're on the Aristotle section when we talk about this,
yeah.
where Aristotle says where he's talking about the phoneme, like the importance of the phoneme and why it's not
yeah.
a letter. You know, it's like because it has the potential to be combined into a word, which animals
yeah.
make sounds and they make distinctive sounds, but those
mm-hmm.
sounds don't form words. They can't form words. So it's all organized around this notion. I mean, everything about that is organized around the notion of the idea.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, right. Well, I mean, and you get in Heidegger too, like sort of both with the fetishizing of the Greeks and kind of the centralizing of the animal consciousness too, like where it's like because they're not dwelling in mediation, they have a more immediate access to the will to power or whatever it is, you know. And the Greeks also, by extension, they weren't oversaturated in representation, right? So they had some sort of more immediate existence. And that's enviable for Heidegger. So it's
yeah,
like we
yeah.
there is that sense that we have to return to this place of immediacy and Dionysian sort of, you know.
Although
like
I think
ecstasy.
That, but that's where to give Heidegger his due and why he doesn't like metaphors, that's not sensory, right? Like it's not simply that return to the more originary is itself an already a being with dwelling. That is
yeah.
not simply a question of like the sensory as distinct from the intelligible.
Yeah,
right.
yeah, that's
right.
I mean, in other words, like, this is his sort of building on Herceral as well, right? I mean, like, that sort of...
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Complexifying of, you know, like, there's not an immediate... I mean, I think for Heidegger, there's not an immediate sensory even possible that it's all sort of...
No, within, but...
Like,
but
worlding,
there,
right?
There is a sense
so that's
like,
why... But that's also sort of why you wouldn't have something like a phenomenology for Heidegger. Like, even though we pointed out a lot of links, but there isn't first a sensory that then is transcended to something like to a higher and sublated to a higher level. Like, it's not a series of stages. Mm-hmm. You know, even interconnected stages and dynamic right. stages, but there aren't stages.
That's what I meant by bringing up Herceral. I mean, I don't know my Herceral very well, but that is my sense of Herceral, is that it's sort of like staged from the sensory, like the phenomenology
yeah.
is staged right. from the sensory to the conceptual to the
right.
you know to,
right.
to the world
to spirit
to yeah. spirit. Yeah, I guess my yeah. sense of Herceral. I mean, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but like my understanding of sort of like Heidegger's departure from that is that. The worlding, you begin with worlding.
Yeah. It's always
you
being
begin with.
With
sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as a side note, I think Husserl's phenomenology is much more vulgar, and there's the discrete domains, right? So, like, the sensory domain is in itself sensory, right? And then you move to mediation, mm-hmm. etc. Hegel, I think, you know, as my little Hegel fanboy that I am, I think he's a little more... complex than that, but I mean with Heidegger, but then how would you characterize his return to the Greeks or his fascination with Greek life? Then would it be that the usure is like less saturated, like where it's like it's not an oversaturated use of representational language at that moment in time, right? Where they're able to sort of live. How would you characterize that? Like,
it depends.
Why
it depends
is that better?
Right. Like, it depends on how we read Heidegger, right? Because there's, and he does, he negotiates it more or less deftly in different places where he says, mm-hmm. this isn't a question of it being overwritten and erased. That doesn't mean it was simply present for them either, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, so there yeah. are places where he does say that kind of thing. So it kind of depends on which Heidegger we look at. But
yeah.
the kind of, the big, sort of caricatured picture of Heidegger that we've been mostly dealing with is that, yeah, there's something at play in language that has gotten covered over in the representational thinking of language that's prior to and the condition of possibility for representation that one mm-hmm. can still reactivate but not represent. That would be mm-hmm. the important part, right? Like, and why it would distinguish itself. It's not like we can get back to it and adequately show it. You know, because then
because
it
I
would
think,
be its own representational.
Because the mm-hmm. kind of primacy that Heidegger is after is, I don't think, a sensory or embodied or material originality. But I think the primacy is more of, I mean, what is proper to design is to think its own being. And emphasis there, I think, maybe on thinking. And so, like, the problem of both a originary primitive sensory language and a highly abstracted, you know, technical language is the sort of the rigidity with which the signifier and sign are attached to each other, which then only allows for like mechanistic relationships. It doesn't allow for the kind of ambiguity that is essential for thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound?
Yeah. No, yeah.
Right.
I mean, I guess I was sort of using the vulgarized version of Heidegger, where it's like just a fetishizing of the Greeks. But obviously, as we learned in our season on Heidegger, there's much more nuanced take
in
Nietzsche, too. Yeah. In place, like with the whole treatment of the Overman. The Overman is not a return to the simplicity of the Greek life. You know, it's something totally different. It's a transmutation. It's a change. Certainly not an Hegelian Aufhebung, but there's a complexity to that sort of ethical insistence on changing our way of relating that's not simply a, let's get back to, you know, the homestead, let's get back to making fires kind of shit, you know.
But that certainly gets taken up as one of the Heideggerian mm-hmm. motifs, if we could sort of simplify, right, and get mm-hmm. back to the natural. And so that's not, you know, it's certainly not unavailable in Heidegger. It's quite available. mm-hmm. Heidegger is for the environmentalist types.
Yes.
T- talking to you, Nathaniel Rivers.
Well, no, I mean, a lot of people, like, you know, whenever I know someone is a Heideggerian, I often think, well, and they do turn out to often be those, like, hey, I like nature right. more than I like, you know.
Yeah.
I'll take the Fusus over Nomos every time. Right?
But again, but that usage of Heidegger is, it's a limited, right, it's like, let's return to the richer expansiveness of life that we have detached from. I mean, that right. is not, Heidegger is not always about that, or he's not right. really about that at all in some cases, you know. The whole, like, the post-humanist kind of, right, the point of departure for a lot of post-humanism via Heidegger, right, that kind of vein of that research mm-hmm. is Descartes, right? We have yeah. to get away from the binaries yeah. of Descartes in order to return to what was before those binaries.
That's right.
And Heidegger's whole take on that is that being is always withdrawn or is always withheld from us.
That's
so
right.
even Descartes' mistake, right, in his opposition of body and mind, or, you know, in his whole presupposition of there being a transparent consciousness, that contains a relevant truth for Heidegger.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
our withdrawal from being, right? That's right. a constitutive moment, you know, in human
That's
being.
Where I mean, so, I agree with you. That's where I always think, like, the big Heidegger lesson is the problematizing of being as presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, now you can certainly say one can learn that in Hegel, right? Like, and I will agree to that. It's just super explicit in Heidegger,
yeah.
like, being is mm-hmm. not presence. And so there is no there that you could just be like, ah, let's get back to the originary sense of being. It's not right. it's not originary. So, but it's mm-hmm. not until you get to Derrida that you get the self-conscious complication of those distinctions, I think, right? Like, the same kinds of moves, problematizing of being as presence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
is there a way of thinking the passage of, I mean, we at one point said, like, none of us really know how to talk about metaphor right now, and I understand the futility of trying, but still like to be able to have at least wrap my head around
a little bit. I know, and I have such an allergic reaction to the word metaphor now. Like, anytime someone comes, it's like, oh, that's a metaphor. I always want to, and it's the delusion in me that's like, there are no metaphors. Right, like, I just yeah. wanted to say, like, let's just take the hard line. Like, there are no metaphors. When I use, for instance, as I frequently do, use viral metaphor. Like, we got to infect students, right? We got to come up with yeah. ways of infecting the ways that they think. And they're like, oh yeah, that's a metaphor. I'm like, no, it's actual infection, because infection isn't owned by the biological milieu and then being transported into a conceptual milieu. It is not owned by any place. So it's an actual, and as much, I'm not saying it's the same thing, but as much as, you know, the virus infects, the thinking infects. Like, it is the same word.
Obviously, you know, different, right. or rather, it's a different apparatus.
Obviously, different mechanisms. But, yeah. but that's where you're like, it's not the same word, right? In a different milieu.
Yeah.
That's again, I'm back to the whole style question. It's always this question of repetition and difference, sameness and difference. Like, how do you locate that even provisionally?
Yeah.
I mean, so often when we talk about metaphor in the Nietzschean sense, we always have to, like, be very careful and say, like, this is not metaphor in the traditional
right.
sense. Like, this is just like it's a metaphor of metaphors. It's outside of its proper domain or whatever,
right?
right? But it just seems like there's maybe a more ready passage between those commonplace senses of metaphor and the Nietzschean sense of metaphor, which is like, if you start to erode the possibility of the proper and improper place, and you start thinking about, like, no, these are, we literally infect, you know, like the conservatives were right in the, you know, the 90s, and, like, we are infecting students with, you know,
yes.
like, perhaps not intentionally, certainly not programmatically or, like, top down, like, you know, we're uploading them with ideas, but they're definitely getting infected, right? Then suddenly that sense of, like, that supposed non-metaphor, that literalness sounds a whole lot like the metaphor of interpretation, or the metaphor that Nietzsche talks about. It's just pure appropriation, just one thing. This is why I keep on coming back to the labor or the activity of something, one thing working on another thing.
Thinking with.
Yeah.
You're gonna feast on this one.
Conceptuality is something other than itself.
There's been a change in the image of thought.
That's what it is. That's what it is. That's what it is.
The internal structure of becoming.
As soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject.
Thank you.